You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Connor.
Hi, Bob.
How are you?
Doing well. How are you?
Good. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show. You are Connor Friedersdorf. And Connor, in times such as the ones we're in, times of discord, bitterness, snark, political polarization, we turn to a person like you.
All right.
You are possibly the world's most earnest and least snarky, most civil, least ironic, perhaps, opinion journalist. Has anyone ever pointed this out to you?
It could be. There could be a grain of truth in there.
Yeah.
I find it hard to be. I think that Twitter is a medium. I've kept thinking that just brings out negativity and snark. I do not think I'm immune to that. But I do think that that is a pretty good characterization of the pieces I write for The Atlantic.
Okay. And you do write for The Atlantic. What's your title? What are you, senior editor or something?
Oh, I think I'm a staff writer. I think we may have gone to accurate magazine titles.
Oh, really?
Bucking the trend.
Ah. Well, that's progress. Back when I was at the New Republic, Mike Kinsley used to say, a contributing editor is someone who doesn't contribute and doesn't edit.
Right.
Which was more or less true. But you actually write, and you're called a staff writer, which is good.
Yes.
And anything else you want to say by way of introduction? What's your Twitter handle?
My Twitter handle's @Connor64. And if anyone happens to be in the market for a biography of one of the guys who founded SeaWorld, then you can go to Amazon, and Meeting Triumph and Disaster is the title of it.
It's funny. I just met somebody, like, they were just on the subway, and they said, "Do you know where I can find a biography of one?" Yeah, it happens all the time.
Yeah, so I think I'll reach that
person. So wait,
person.
What's the title of this?
It's Meeting Triumph and Disaster, and it's a biography of a guy. He grew up in the Depression in Los Angeles and went off to fight in World War II. And my favorite part of the project was he sent a couple hundred pages of letters home to his wife from the Pacific where he was fighting, and gave a pretty interesting look inside of a marriage. But he's most famous for going on to found SeaWorld, and it's kind of the largest, most thorough account of that that's ever been written, and gets into a little bit of the early controversy.
I didn't know about this book. When did this book come out?
It just went up on Amazon recently. So,
but it has been published?
It has been published, and I have not done anything to promote it except for say this right now.
Except for this. So this is the beginning.
This is the beginning.
And it'll get bigger.
We'll see.
This sounds like a laudable book to write. It doesn't sound like a crassly opportunistic book to write. It's not like you were like, hey, what's hot now? Right?
Well, that's true. I mean, I started this years ago, and the patriarch of this family was the grandfather of someone I went to high school with, and I just stumbled onto an interesting story and figured out, hey, I'll learn how to write a book, and we'll see how that goes. And all these Saturdays later, now we have a book.
Well, we'll all go out and get it now that we know about it. And your job is to make more people know about it.
Yes.
So let's talk about the times we're in, notably the era of Trumpism, which you've written a fair amount about. We are around the time when everyone's giving him a 100-day checkup. Mm-hmm. And maybe we should actually start by filling in a little of your ideological background, where you see, I think of you as somewhat libertarian, maybe libertarian, maybe, is that more or less accurate?
It's more or less accurate, yeah.
So much of his, well, you take it from there. What is your view of him from that vantage point?
Well, there's actually one way in which Trump's election has made me a little bit more of a small C conservative. And it's in this way. I've been reading this fascinating book called The Authoritarian Dynamic by a woman named Karen Stenner, who was a, I think she's a political scientist, although she could have been in the psychology department at Princeton. And she wrote this book in 1995. Jonathan Haidt actually turned me onto it. And it basically, to really do maybe injustice to the argument, but she talks about this inclination that we have that perhaps we will be on this arc of history that makes progress over time, and that insofar as there is ugliness or racism or intolerance, it's because people have been acculturated the wrong way, and if only we could educate or acculturate them better, then all of our problems would be over. And she posits, after doing a bunch of research, both across countries and a little bit of social science laboratory research, that across eras and countries, there are just a certain number of people who are what are dubbed authoritarian in her taxonomy, which is to say that they prefer sameness and unity, and they're really uncomfortable with diversity and difference. And she posits that this faction of people will always be a threat in liberal democracies because it is the diversity and difference of opinion, and sometimes racial diversity, though not always, in liberal democracies that triggers the latent authoritarian predispositions in these people.
Now, how did these people get these predispositions? Is she saying this is like a genetic thing? Some fraction of the population is just genetically predisposed to...
She doesn't talk about genetics, but I think the way that she phrases it is a perhaps innate predisposition to this, although I think she would be, and this is kind of deep in the weeds, but I think she would be open to the idea that it is not genetic. But nevertheless, she has found it across eras and countries. Mm-hmm. And so she basically encourages her readers to accept this feature of the world as given, for now at least, and to change the way that we relate to other people in this society by supposing that there are just people that are uncomfortable with difference, and if we don't want them to do things like elect Donald Trump, then we have to take that into account and organize things in a way that doesn't make them feel extremely alarmed.
Which means, for example, restrictionist immigration policies?
Well, she actually focuses much more on rhetoric than she does on substance, and I think that this is maybe an area where I would like to see her flesh out her own scholarship more, although maybe she has in other papers, but she talks about, for example, if we're going to talk about diversity in a city, there are two ways that we could formulate this thought, right? One is, oh, look at how awesome it is that all of these people are coming from all around the world, and yet we have so much in common. We're all humans, and we have so much alike, and that's great. And look at how they're coming in and embracing these traditional immigrant values in America, and et cetera, et cetera. The other way that you could look at it is, oh, isn't it wonderful? We have people coming from all over the country, and it's so wonderful and exciting how different we all are. Isn't it amazing just how different and fun and diverse, right? And so she would argue that talking about things in the second way, although it's well-intentioned or perhaps just earnest saying what one thinks, because mm-hmm. there are these people who love diversity and difference, this is counterproductive in some way and likely to activate authoritarians. Now, my colleague David Frum has made kind of a similar argument with regard to restrictionist immigration. The way that he put it is, if liberals won't enforce borders, then voters will hire fascists to do so. And that could be right. I don't know. It seems to me that there is a big gap between between responding to this reality by just giving way on a bunch of liberal priorities, or on the other hand, responding to it by just thinking more carefully about the way that we frame different things, the arguments that we use, the rhetoric that politicians as opposed to political journalists use.
Can you flesh that out? So difference between giving way on liberal priorities, meaning what?
I mean, a difference between substance and rhetoric. I mean, something like from an immigration, right? Like, this thesis of his could be correct. It doesn't incline me to just go all the way toward a Frumian position on immigration. I think that there are other alternatives than that, even if we bear these insights in mind, right? Mm-hmm. For example, it might be that the country has kind of organized itself into people in big cities who are relatively comfortable with diversity and people in the interior of the country who are relatively uncomfortable with it. So perhaps if we're going to resettle Syrian refugees, we should put fewer of them in Wyoming, as we've put a lot of them there, for basically reasons of housing stock, and maybe there were call centers who would take them or whatever. And even though maybe there are, even though housing's a little bit more expensive in the cities, maybe we'll minimize the backlash by having that be the first place that they go.
Okay.
So that's an example of how we could, respond to these insights without actually going all the way and abandoning the substantive policy that we want to have.
Okay, so are you saying that, like, you're more drawn to the view that kind of given basic core realities about human society, if we don't want a person like Trump, we need to take kind of preemptive measures that are in some ways different from the things you would have championed 2 years ago.
I'm a little bit more inclined to the view that there's a crooked timber of humanity, and that we can't educate or acculturate our way out of some of these things that we dislike completely.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't, the thesis that like in all societies there's just this fixed, relatively fixed percentage of people who are latently pro-authoritarian, that, I don't know why I have to go that far. That doesn't seem all that necessarily plausible to me. I mean, there is a crooked timber of humanity view that makes sense to me, which is that people are prone to fear. Mm-hmm. So if you can convince them, for example, that terrorism actually has a greater chance of getting them killed than it does, they'll vote for you. People care about their relative social status. They want respect. And so if they can be convinced that coastal elites hold them in contempt, that they're losing status relative to elites, that, their kids are not going to have a better future than them, blah, 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 then, and if you can convince them that the reason is, one reason is illegal immigration, then that will have a certain impact on views. And I'm not saying all these things are wrong. I mean, immigration does have a short-term impact on, available jobs, even if you buy the view that in the long term, it enhances prosperity. Right. So, seems to me, human nature, Donald Trump is illustrating a lot of features of human nature that are not hugely surprising to me, and he's illustrating that these parts of human nature can be evoked under certain circumstances, periods of rapid change. I mean, that's the other thing, is just people can only absorb change so fast, and including demographic change. So I guess, I buy all that. I'm a little skeptical of this hypothesis you started off with, but that. Because for one thing, it almost seems like a form of scapegoating. Like, it's a way of saying, okay, the problem is the Trump voters. Because they are this small fraction of the population that exists in all societies, and they have this latent authoritarianism, and they're the ones you had to watch out for. I think the problem is human nature.
Well, so there's one thing you said that I want to be careful about. I don't know that she says that it's literally a fixed percentage, 15% across countries.
Yeah, not that precisely, but there is
a sizable cohort. But I guess I don't think that it is scapegoating in the sense. I mean, if we just reduce it actually to this insight, and I don't know if this strikes you as more intuitively true or not. But one thing that struck me as intuitively true is that this relationship to difference and sameness, people who get energy when they encounter something new or when they encounter diversity, and on the other hand, people who kind of clam up or are a little bit fearful of it, that strikes me as a thing that I see in the world. And it doesn't even have to do we don't even necessarily have to talk about this in terms of ethnic diversity.
There is a dimension, and personality psychologists have these five dimensions of personality. Uh-huh. One of them is openness. I think means largely to new experience, but I think that might correlate with what you're talking about. So go ahead.
And so when I think, for example, about I've been thinking a lot about the press, the political press, the media generally, and if there's the possibility anymore of reaching people who don't already share a certain ideological view that they incline to come to you because they wanted to find that thing. And one thing that was I was thinking about, people always talk about bias in media as a kind of left-right metric, or people like Glenn Greenwald will talk about perhaps a corporate bias or a pro-war bias. I think there are all kinds of metrics among which we could say the media leans this way or that way, wittingly or not. And I think that a kind of media personality type, I think a journalist is much more likely to be one of these people who are excited by difference, and that they write about new topics in a way that reflects this. If you look at the coverage of something like transgender rights, say, there's not only the impulse to cover this new thing because it's interesting and we're it's interesting and we're interested in newness and we like diversity. It's not just the impulse to cover it, but the way that the coverage plays out. And it's perhaps the case that a different kind of coverage that is nevertheless friendly would go more toward advancing acceptance of transgender people or transgender rights, but that the journalists, the coverage that the journalists actually put forth presumes that everyone shares this mental state, unwittingly presumes that everyone shares this mental state of being excited by difference. And that's just kind of baked in, and people aren't thinking of the kind of work that Haidt has done on the different moral psychologies of different people and appealing to it. So the book just made me think about a bunch of different things from a different perspective than I had. And it's kind of been obsessing me lately. I've written a few pieces invoking her. There's one more piece of it actually that I'll mention because I think it's really interesting. In her taxonomy, there are these libertarians, that's her word for people that just like difference and diversity. And then there are the authoritarians, the people who want sameness and unity and are willing to use coercive measures to enforce it if necessary. And then there are conservatives. And in the work that she does, she's very careful to distinguish between conservatives and libertarians, or I'm sorry, conservatives and authoritarians, and to say that she has found differences in this outlook and that how conservatives react in these moments when authoritarians start to assert themselves goes a long way toward telling you how bad it's going to be, basically. And so
they're like the swing vote.
They're like the swing vote. And because on one hand, they have a status quo bias. And insofar as the status quo in a country like the United States has been these liberal democratic values and generally acceptance of diversity, you know, you can think, you can just go to National Review and think about the conservatives who have this status quo bias that's cutting against Trump right now. And on the other hand, there are times when conservatives have allied with the authoritarians. If you think about someone like Barry Goldwater, he wasn't an authoritarian. He was someone who allied with authoritarians because they shared this thing, which is that they didn't want a big federal government, right? You can think of William F. Buckley, who had a status quo bias, and the status quo at the time was Jim Crow, right? And cut in the wrong direction. And so Stenner would advise us to those of us who are on the libertarian side to try and reach out and cultivate the conservatives and not lump them in with the authoritarians and assume that they are lost.
Yeah, that makes sense as an attitude. I'm not sure I buy that conceptualization of people at National Review. I mean, I don't see so much a status quo bias as an ideological tension between their ideology and Trump's. I mean, they are free traders.
Uh-huh.
They are largely more or less neoconservative on foreign policy. And Trump, I'd say you give him another 3 weeks and he will be a mainstream neoconservative on foreign policy. Yeah. That's clearly where he's moving. But if you look at the tension between kind of, you know, how National Review became more or less a never Trump place, why isn't it easily explicable in terms of actual ideology? Plus the fact that he's just like a gross, creepy guy. And kind of elites in general thought, oh God, surely we're better than this, right? I mean,
I think there's some truth to that. But I find it hard to tease apart the National Review ideology and status quo bias insofar as there's a heavy overlap of, you know, National Review ideology is free trading, and that has been the approach, the posture of the United States for decades.
Yeah, but it's disruptive. It's not, and this has been pointed out by, I guess, Daniel Bell and the Cultural Contradictions of Capitalism. I mean, to champion untrammeled capitalism, including free trade, is to champion rapid change and disruption. It's not, if you want to champion the status quo, you should be an economic nationalist.
But not if the status quo has long been rapid change, which has been the case in the American economy.
Well, so, if you're defining rapid change as a status quo, I guess I concede the point. But you see the irony.
I actually think it's a good example of how authoritarians would be against free trade because they prize stability and sameness. Conservatives are a different animal, and free trade kind of reflects that in a way. I'm curious what you think about, you know, you've been observing the trajectory of American politics and foreign policy a little bit longer than I have, and I wonder what you make of Trump's veering toward neoconservatism and why the establishment foreign policy posture is just seemingly so overwhelming. Like, despite all of its failures, it seems that even the even a relatively modest statement like the United States cannot intervene in Syria and have predictably good results, say, just seems still like heresy in Washington, despite Obama and Trump both winning elections, campaigning as sort of anti-war-ish in some ways, at least, mm-hmm. candidates. And despite the ensuing failures of the Obama administration in Libya, and despite this whole contingent of Hillary Clinton people who were for Iraq and then for Libya and then for Syria still, and didn't seem to show any recognition that stuff they had supported in the past had gone terribly wrong. Mm-hmm. How does it endure so powerfully? There are people who would say, oh, well, there's just tons of defense money in Washington, D.C., and it's just an economic determinism, a kind of military-industrial complex, quid pro quo. That could be going on, I guess. I'm sure there's some of it. It doesn't seem like everything that's going on. I know too many journalists who fall in this camp and aren't getting money from the defense industry and aren't hoping to one day. But I'm kind of baffled by the ideology and by its endurance, despite it all.
I mean, if you want to look at money that shapes foreign policy discourse in Washington, it's not just the defense industry. I mean, first of all, you know, foreign policy is famously not something people by and large care about. So mm-hmm. it's much more of an elite preoccupation. So, you know, if you can influence the expression of elite opinion in Washington in particular, you've gone a long way, because you probably don't have a lot of grassroots sentiment to battle one way or the other, at least not intrinsically. So where does the money come from? I mean, yeah, I would say, you know, and there's a limited number of, I mean, because it's not a grassroots thing, it is very, the subsidizing of opinion and policy advocacy in Washington is very much a special interest thing. And there's only a few special interests that care much about foreign policy, certainly when it comes to Syria. One you mentioned, the defense industry. There's famously the so-called pro-Israel lobby. I personally don't think the things they advocate are good for Israel, so I consider that kind of an ironic title. But anyway, if we specify that we're talking about the right-wing pro-Israel lobby, and not like J Street, which is also pro-Israel, but more on sure. the left. That's number two. They spend a lot of money on people like Sheldon Adelson, who have given money to things like the Foundation for Defense of Democracy, and so on. And then third, increasingly, there is Sunni Arab money from Sunni Arab states, which, when it comes to Syria, is on the same page as the pro-Israel lobby, and on the same page as the defense manufacturer. So those are, if you look at where the money goes, where the money comes from for think tanks in Washington, it's a lot of it is traceable to one of those three sources. And on something like missile strikes in Syria, they're all on the same page. Now, and you know, having watched, I paid a lot of attention to the Iran deal, and having just watched that play out, you might be surprised by how important that money is. If you just look at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies alone, and there was a good piece by John Judas in Slate, it's worth looking at, which is, you know, very much kind of right-wing pro-Israel money. The influence is considerable. And the thing is, it isn't just about the sudden advocacy of missile strikes. There's like an ongoing kind of influence on like how Iran is conceived.
Yeah.
I mean, let me just give you one example. How many times have you heard Iran called like the most destabilizing power in the Middle East?
Sure, yeah.
Now, technically, you know, if you're just a political scientist or a political scientist from Mars and you come down and go, okay, so what happened in Syria? And they say, well, the government faced this rebellion. Iran is on the side of the government. Well, in a technical sense, that's the opposite of destabilizing, right? We define stability as the preservation of government control in states. I mean, that's a strictly, you know, non-ideological, amoral kind of political scientist view. Right. And from the Syrian side, I mean, obviously, it's a brutally oppressive regime, and you can say they had it coming in terms of the rebellion, but it's also true that, A, in a technical sense, a government that backs up the existing regime is not, in technical terms, destabilizing, and B, we and our allies, I think, turned a revolt that might have been brutally oppressed at the cost of thousands of lives into a civil war that cost hundreds of thousands by arming the rebels. Okay. Now, almost everything I've just said, you never hear, right? I mean, right. You almost never hear.
Even more surprising to me in some ways is that you never hear, if anyone even goes so far as Obama to talk with Iran to cut a deal with Iran, there's all kinds of demagoguery about how you're dealing with this country that calls America the Great Satan and is, as you say, the language is the most destabilizing force in the Middle East, right? And I see the partisan alignments and money and how this kind of demagoguery is almost inevitable, as unfortunate as it probably is. What I never understand is how our alliance with Saudi Arabia doesn't attract, doesn't generate the same kind of demagoguery, which is to say there are candidates running for office against incumbents. These incumbents are supporting Saudi Arabia in a way that's pretty difficult to defend, especially given their ties to 9/11, especially given the role of Sunni terrorism and its effect on Americans as opposed to Shia terrorism right. And its effect on Americans, which is almost negligible, at least in the United States. And so why aren't just ambitious politicians who are willing to be demagogues taking up the demagoguery on the other side and exerting that kind of pressure?
Because there's no money in it. Because there's no money in it.
But there are votes in it, presumably, right?
No, again, people don't care about foreign policy. I mean, if I go to middle America and say, don't you realize that as we complain about the indiscriminate killing of babies in Syria, which we rightly do, we are supporting, helping Saudi Arabia indiscriminately kill babies in Yemen. I mean, they don't care. And it's not that they're bad people. It's just that, like, you know, the average person focuses on the issues that are of most immediate concern, and it's just a fact most people don't care about that kind of distant issue. If you're a politician in Washington, all the money is on the side of hypocrisy, and the media, in I think more pervasive and subtle ways than we realize, reinforces the narrative.
Yeah, well,
some of it's a mystery to me, even to be honest, how pervasive it is. But
yeah, well, I think we're caught between mystery and agreement, so maybe we should go to something else.
Yeah, but I mean, it is a mystery. It's not a mystery. I think a lot of it's not a mystery to me, but I think it's very bad for us. It's not good for America, and it's not good for the world that we don't see these things more clearly. Personally, so what should we move on to? What should be done about Trump? By and large, I think you and I are not fans. The one thing he said during the campaign that I was kind of drawn to, which was some things about non-interventionism and foreign policy, seemed to be no longer relevant.
Yeah.
First of all, is there anything you like about him, or are you willing to move on to the question of what should be done about him?
Oh, I think I'm willing to move on to what should be done. The tiny number of things I could have imagined him doing that would maybe be good, he's not even doing those things. So
Right. So do you think the resistance is being handled, well, not, is being wise in the way it?
No.
Okay. What? This is something of real interest to me. What do you think is wrong with the resistance?
So many things. First, to me, there's this thing that's going to happen in 2018. There are these midterm elections, and I want the Democrats to focus on winning them and to be as effective as possible in winning them. I wish there were more activist energy going right now, even to registering voters and canvassing and organizing to win that election. It is the most important thing that's going to determine the trajectory of the Trump presidency is, on one hand, a trajectory where the Democrats retake the House. Well, that would be huge. Even if they just made a bunch of gains and Republicans were really scared, right? And maybe a few people who are pro-Trump get voted out of office. Even that would be a big change. On the other hand, if Trump is able to pick off some Republicans in primaries that are unfriendly to him and replace them with Trumpian candidates, that changes the whole trajectory of the Republican Party going forward. And it just positions him in a very different way. I mean, we won't get into all of the possible scenarios, but it just seems like a very important and obvious lever of power. That is a big thing that you should do. And I fear that instead there are just a lot of marches organized around like a different metric or identity group. And like, do they lead to anything? Maybe they do. I was glad that there were marches the day after the inauguration. I thought that they were huge and it was an important signal of widespread disgust and perhaps a little bit of a break on momentum. But the farther it goes and the more little causes it is and the more it depletes, the more I worry that it is just another Occupy Wall Street. Even Black Lives Matter, which has gotten a lot of attention and has put together a very coherent and smart, I think, reform agenda, has in its optics and strategy not done very well. So I think the biggest thing I would say is I wish there were more focus on electoral politics and the most obvious lever of change. The other thing I'd say is that I think this speaks to a larger problem of activist energy on the left that is just not focused on achieving ends. In Occupy Wall Street, there were a bunch of people who were focused on a common thing that they thought was wrong, the global financial industry, right? And you could imagine all sorts of particular asks that they could have gone to at a moment when a lot of populist energy was on their side. And one thing that they focused on at the ground level was having their movement reflect the sorts of power structures that they think ought to exist in the world, which is to say non-hierarchical, horizontal. Everything we do, we're going to sit around and decide it by consensus in a big circle. And it was just obviously
it was anarchist in its underlying philosophy, right?
Maybe. I don't know. But it certainly was anti-hierarchical, and it made decisions in a way that to me guaranteed or at least subserviated the substantive end that I think they should have been focused on. Black Lives Matter, sort of the same way. There's this little piece of it, Campaign Zero, that I can't, as someone who's been writing about police abuses and reform for a lot longer than Black Lives Matter has been around, I can't compliment them highly enough on putting together a very coherent list of things that they want local police departments to adopt that are just tremendously smart. And a lot of them are already in place. They're best practices in some places. It's just a totally viable agenda. Partly through no fault of their own, they're being portrayed as this radical force by people on the other side who are just dishonest. And so that's certainly going on. At the same time, they have this ideological relationship to what they would call respectability politics, and I would call it just politics, just trying to win. They're very averse to it, and I think that it has hurt them. And then there's this last piece, and I think this is the least important piece, but nevertheless, I'm going to mention it because it is a little bit orthogonal to something I've been writing about, which is speech on campus, and so I've seen it up close. I went to the Claremont Colleges. I graduated 15 years ago in 2002, And when I was there, there was this kid who was shot in Claremont named Irvin Landrum Jr. He was, I think, 18 years old, a black male, shot on pretty near the campus, was not a student. There was a gun found beside him. The cops said that there was a gun. The gun turned out that there were no fingerprints on it, and the last person it was registered to was the police chief in a neighboring town. And so there was tremendous suspicion. And this is one of the biggest activist causes of the time when I was in college. And I remember as a student journalist going to Claremont City Council meetings. It's a small municipality where even though Claremont colleges are relatively small, they could be a pretty big block if everyone actually registered to vote where they were at in college. And so there was a lot of push for policy changes within the police department and pressure for the city manager to resign and all of this very specific local stuff. And this is an area of California where you have the Claremont Police Department, the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, and the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department, all very close to one another, right near the colleges, and all policing organizations that could have tremendous improvements in what they do to this day. I went back to give a speech at Pomona College where I went, and a few days before, Heather McDonald, the Manhattan Institute scholar, had been shut down there. And again, there are a bunch of
students. What is their issue with her, by the way? She's been on Blogging Heads a few times. What is, I mean, she is conservative, but is there a particular position of hers that is the source of her vilification?
Well, she says in a way that is very provocative to them that police officers and police departments are the institution in American life most dedicated to the proposition that Black Lives Matter. That's almost a direct quote. And that stop and frisk policing saved thousands of black lives, mm-hmm. and that Black Lives Matter itself is part of war on cops that is causing the murder rate to spike. And there's a lot of ground for pretty sharp disagreement. Although the way that they characterize her ranges from hyperbolic to inaccurate, which is to say, they would characterize her as wanting to, quote, erase black lives or, you know, a whole list of things that aren't true about her. And she's someone I disagree with tremendously about this issue. But anyway, so they shut down this Heather McDonald speech. And it is a coalition of people who have been partly motivated by this Black Lives Matter movement, right? But, like, notice this change in focus where the thing you were protesting was the local police department. The thing you're protesting now is a speaker coming to campus who has nothing even to do with local police, mm-hmm. Outside of New York. And you're not doing anything about the local police department, even though it's right there. And, you know, you can think back to bygone generations of, like, think of the leftists who want to use violence in order to carry out their ends. And you can think of times when they were inspired to use violence by their opposition to the Vietnam War, right? By institutions like DuPont. You had radicals robbing Bank of America in the 70s, right? Now you have literal black-clad radicals with weapons, and their goal is to shut down an Ann Coulter speech. Like, there are people who are motivated to use violence, and the target...
Did they have actual weapons? They had guns?
It was the Milo speech that they were armed and had weapons and shut it down.
They had guns?
I don't know if they had guns. They had... Mm-hmm. Fireworks, they had clubs, like they came ready to fight and with stuff to do so. And like, I'm not advocating violence against other people, just to be very clear, but it is an odd focus if you're the kind of person who is willing to go so far as to use violence to pick as your target shutting down like hack provocateurs, right? Like, if you succeed in doing it, then what? Trump is still in power,
like the,
right?
So, like, in the 60s and 70s, at least they robbed banks and stuff.
At least they had an accurate impression of
tried to blow up ROTC buildings.
Where power lay and how to challenge it. And for whatever reason, we've gone from this shift.
Well, I mean, look, it is, just as a tactical matter, controlling speech is power. I mean, if they make people... afraid to say certain things, of course, but the irony is they won't. I mean, Ann Coulter, whether she can show up on Berkeley itself doesn't matter in terms of her getting her message out. In fact, It probably helps her get her message out to be denied access to Berkeley because she's got so many other platforms, and now she'll have more attention than ever. So that's kind of the irony. I mean, so I'm coming around to agree with you that this is, leaving aside the legality, morality, etc., it's an ineffectual tactic.
Sure. Then here in California, where I pay pretty close attention to politics, on one hand, I'm glad that there are elected leaders in California who are antagonistic to Trump, partly because I believe that federalism is, and states can be, a check on federal power gone wrong, partly because I just don't like Trump. And I, you know, anyone who's speaking up with a prominent voice against him, I'm for that. There's a part of me that worries that the mayor of Los Angeles, Eric Garcetti, or various elected officials in the Bay Area, you know, there's a lot of homeless people in Los Angeles, more than I can ever remember in all the time I've lived here. And the LAPD remains not a perfect institution, right? It's not as if some of the biggest problems that liberals or progressives have with society right now are all attributable to Trump. And in fact, California is basically empowered to do whatever it wants about homelessness. And both the state and localities can do whatever they want about policing abuses. These are all state and local issues. And Trump has not yet, although he may one day, but he has not yet overstepped that and prevented localities from doing anything that they want. Black Lives Matter as a whole, which I think is a very urgent movement, and that there are really crazy police abuses all over the country. Many of them do happen in places that are completely controlled by Democrats in big cities, basically. And it's not, I'm not saying it's all the fault of the Democrats. There's a police union part to this. There's a cultural part to this. All kinds of things going on. But to make Trump the boogeyman of everything is to ignore all of these things that he has not caused. And so a part of me worries about that, too.
Okay, so far you've talked about ways that, in your view, the resistance is failing to focus on things that would advance its agenda more effectively. Yes. You know, focus on the midterm elections, focus on specific issues where you disagree with Trump, like on the relationship between police and the community, but focus on that issue. What about cases... And this is a real concern of mine, where the resistance is actually counterproductive, not just inefficient or ineffectual, but actually in the way it talks about Trump, the way it does certain things, energizing and hardening his base.
Well, I think that happens. I mean, as someone who's very alarmed about Trump, it's relatively often that I open my computer and I'm surfing around and deciding what to write about, or reading different journalistic outlets and watching what people are saying on Twitter. And I'm like rolling my eyes pretty often at some claim that someone makes about something that Trump is doing that seems like, even as someone who's very alarmed by a lot of what he's doing, I think, come on, you're just misrepresenting this, or come on, you can't really be worried about that thing. You don't have to think very long. It seems to me that if you put yourself in other people's shoes, it's very rare for someone to come to you and express something in the most hyperbolic way, in the most alarmist way imaginable, and have that persuade you better.
Well, especially if you're starting out on the other side of the fence.
Sure.
Especially if they're talking about your guy.
Yeah, and so, but I really think that there is the notion of outreach and persuasion are both themselves under attack from a certain quarter who wants to discredit them and characterize them as, some people call it, respectability politics. Some people characterize it as, oh, I shouldn't have to do the emotional labor of convincing bigots or Trump supporters. They will characterize all Trump supporters as bigots and make it seem as if outreach to a bigot is somehow wrong or discreditable. There are five or six different rhetorical moves. I don't know if they all are grounded in the same ideology or if they have different ones, but they all amount to an attempt to make persuasion to discourage it somehow, yeah, or to stigmatize it somehow. And I don't know why that happened exactly. But
I'm not happy about it. But it seems like, just first of all, it seems like every time you kind of mischaracterize something that Trump did by way of attacking him, like most recent example, which I've actually talked about already on Blogging Heads, but when he said, you know, the famous thing where he said, you know, Pavarotti's my friend, and when Pavarotti's actually been dead for 10 years, he didn't say Pavarotti is my friend. He said my friend, comma, Pavarotti.
Uh-huh.
Or something like that. Or Pavarotti, a friend of mine. It was really not definitive. It was really ambiguous. Or if you go back to the time when he, you now hear, he refused to shake Angela Merkel's hand. If you look at that video, it's like, somebody, somewhere, some reporter's yelling, shake her hand. It's not clear he even hears him. He's 70 years old. It's like, that's totally not definitive. And there's just a billion things like that. And I just think every time you can convince Trump supporters that the mains, and this stuff does find its way into the mainstream media often. But in any event, it's, you know, kind of becomes, it's taken up by a kind of an anti-Trump chorus. And when you can convince Trump supporters that, it just feeds right into his narrative that it's the lying media. Every time you can show, and
it's exacerbated by a couple of complicating factors. One is that whether it was George W. Bush or Barack Obama, there were a bunch of things that if you're a journalist, just say you're a journalist on Twitter and you're maybe going to retweet something or not retweet it. If it was Barack Obama or George W. Bush, there's a whole category of things. If you saw that come across your Twitter feed, you'd be like, no, that obviously didn't happen. Come on. With Trump, it's very difficult.
It's harder to say because he does more outrageous stuff.
He could do, and really he could do anything. Like it could be just a totally nonsensical, right? Like you can imagine there's no parody Twitter account that could tweet something that you couldn't imagine Trump tweeting. So that's part of it. There's also this way that Trump speaks, and it's very hard to figure out how one should relate to it, right? Because if you've watched...
In terms of sheer comprehension, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, look, I've gone back and watched a fair number of episodes of The Apprentice and other TV appearances and interviews that Donald Trump has given over his career, and I've kind of become attuned to his verbal patterns, and there are a lot of times when I know what he means, or at least I think he means, and it is not what he is literally saying. What he's literally saying is a different thing, and maybe even the implications of what he's saying are a third thing. And so it's like, am I to treat him literally, and then his supporters come and say, well, he didn't mean that, and there's a degree to which they're correct, or am I to not treat him literally, but lots of people are taking his words literally for what he's saying instead of what he's meaning, right? It just cuts in a dozen different directions. And if you're merely trying to do two things, which is to have an accurate understanding of what Trump says and means, which can be different things, and to convey that to people who just want to understand, just to convey the information as accurately as you can, it's very difficult to do sometimes.
But I think there is a tendency, because so many people, justifiably in my view, really don't like him, and many of those people in the media, there has been, maybe less now than before, but there has been a tendency to interpret the ambiguous stuff uncharitably. I mean, like even the common thing that, you know, he encouraged Russia to hack Hillary's email. I personally thought that that comment in context was like, it was kind of half a joke. I mean, I think you could make that claim defensibly.
Yeah.
Well, nobody's going to read it that way.
Well, it's a good example, right? Because it's a good example of how quickly this gets complicated. Because I agree with you that you could interpret that remark charitably and say he was kind of joking. And let's say that he was. Nevertheless, there's this other side of it where he did, in fact, encourage foreign country to hack her email, right?
Ostensibly. And so.
If you're the person, there's conceivably a person in Russia who English is their second language, perhaps, or they're not attuned to the culture. Took it as a statement of I should do this.
The real story there is person who aspires to be president is just totally irresponsible in his speech. Yeah. I think that's an accurate rendering of that, and we just see that all the time with Trump.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And as a news organization, to get just one layer deeper into this, if you're a big news organization, like say NBC News, or let's say if you're Fusion, which is to say a news organization that's not only big but has a bunch of people at the very beginning of their careers, and you're trying to set policy for your whole organization, some of whom are TV, some are print, some digital, and you're trying to tell them how are we going to relate to the things that Trump says, you suddenly find yourself in a very tricky position, because you maybe have a few people who are just going to knock it out of the park. Jake Tapper is someone who can quickly assimilate information of this kind and have a very nuanced way of conveying it, and he's just very good at that, right? Then you have like a 23-year-old who's like not very good at this at all, and they're well-intentioned and they're trying to do their best, but they just don't have the skills to like juggle all of these kinds of things and, with the sophistication that is required for the unprecedented challenge of Trump, right? And you have everyone in between. And so how do you set your policy as the head of this media organization? Do you optimize it for your very smartest employees and have the employees who are less skilled at this thing mess it up all the time? Do you optimize it for the least good employees, and then you make it so that the best employees aren't able to convey the nuance because you don't build in the judgment that's required to do this? Do you have a bifurcated structure? How do you do it? And a lot of news organizations, I think, are struggling with it. Maybe they even haven't even conceived of it as clearly as I've just laid it out. But I think it is a thing that is going on in the media that it hasn't figured out how to deal with.
So
yet.
In other words, you can kind of let somebody like Tapper have an intermittently adversarial attitude without worrying about him abusing it or making it kind of monotonic? Is that the point?
Yeah, or even you can let someone like Tapper have a little bit of license to interpret and convey what Trump probably meant, or to mm-hmm. use common sense and context skills and just Tapper's long experience to mm-hmm. tell viewers, well, this is kind of what's going on. Or you could say, no, you just have to play it straight, and whatever Trump says, just like, gotta take him literally, that we can't be in the business of interpreting, right? You wouldn't want that for Tapper, but maybe you would want it for a younger, less experienced mm-hmm. staffer. And giving the younger, less experienced staffer too much license often will give you the kind of, well, that seems uncharitable, and maybe he didn't actually mean it that way.
Yeah. This is an out-of-left-field question, but do you have a kind of a compare and contrast view on the Washington Post and New York Times these days? The way they're handling all this, and also the way they're handling the modern media environment, I guess, but in the age of Trump.
I don't really. I mean, the way that I read at this point is just so seldom sitting down with the same newspapers every day.
Right.
That, you know, I can think of different people that I follow at the Times and the Post, and, you know, I can think of certain, like the way that, is it David Farenthold covered the tax returns, this iconic thing with the notebook,
right? And all the foundation stuff, I think. The Trump Foundation stuff, right?
Right. But I would fear that anything I said was just a reflection on the people I happen to follow on Twitter and, like, the thing I happen to click through on Facebook. I really don't have a very good impression of, like, an overarching difference between the Times and the Post. I don't know if you do.
A little. I mean, I think on balance, the Post in its straight news coverage, on the one hand, if you think of as straight news reporters, on the one hand, has been maybe a little more careful to keep in check any anti-Trump kind of attitude, in a sense. I mean, I think in the average, you know, maybe on balance. On the other hand, the Washington Post has this kind of intermediate zone between traditional opinion and reporting, the kind of blogs, the Eric Wimple blog, Aaron Blake, and so on. And I think those, also, you know, the Washington Post is more clickbaity in its headlines.
Yeah.
And this zone I'm talking about, the intermediate zone between old-fashioned op-ed and reporting, is particularly illustrative of that. And so I think there you see a lot of, like, you know, Jeff Sessions is no bad, horrible, terrible, weak kinds of headlines that I again, maybe I'm worry that they help Trump supporters go see the media's anti-Trump.
So here I think maybe you are over worrying because, you know, this is something I also thought right after the election when people were upset that Hillary lost and were showing screenshots of a couple of New York Times front pages. I just don't think that the swing voters of Wisconsin and Michigan are tuned into the New York Times.
No, I don't think that's the way it works. I think they look in their Facebook feeds, and I don't know if it's happening, but the way it would happen in this scenario is they would look at their Facebook feeds and say, see, the media did this. Now, I guess thinking about it, they're probably more likely to see out-and-out factual inaccuracy or seeming, you know, greatly exaggerated coverage than worry about this headline in the Post, maybe.
Thinking about it, the biggest shift in a publication that I've seen pre-Trump and post-Trump is Slate. Like the tone and the feel of the site just seems very different to me.
Well, a number of media outlets are making kind of an explicit part of their pitch to people. Like if they want you to sign on to get to see the paywall version or whatever, you know, the Washington Post beneath its logo, it now says democracy dies in darkness, right? Yeah. I mean, you know, I guess that's true. But anyway, no, I think you're right that Slate is a little more mission driven. And of course, they have the Trump cast, which is very good. I don't know if have you listened to the podcast?
I've listened to a couple episodes of it.
It's very good, but yeah, it's basically adversarial to Trump.
There's a story, I think this is something James Bennett told me, although I'm not positive about that. But it was someone who worked at the New York Times years ago and was saying that if you were on a certain desk, one assignment that was kind of widely hated but that everyone had to do was to go to a town that didn't have a direct flight to New York. I think that was the rule. And spend at least a certain amount of time and knock on at least a certain number of doors and be invited into at least a certain number of homes before you were allowed to come home. And the person who related this to me basically said that the stories that came out of this were never the best that came out of the Times. And he only realized years later that this was just training the reporters in a good experience and that it had good effects in other ways. And I really think that this is something that a lot of people doing mostly opinion journalism would do well to just go somewhere where there are Trump voters, somewhere that went for Trump, and just go around talking to people, spend a day or two doing it, because it doesn't take very much time before you just change your whole relationship to what you think motivates people to vote. I mean, a lot of what you find out is it's just people are uninformed and incoherent. Yeah. They voted for someone tells you almost nothing about their actual substantive beliefs.
Yeah, and that you can't call them all bigots. I mean, there's been good work. We had Arlie Rothschild, I think is her name, who wrote a book about, I forget the title, but we had her on some months ago on Meaning of Life TV. I think it's interesting. Some of the non-MSM media is taking this challenge on. What's the name of the guy who emphasizes front row kids, back row kids? You know that guy on Twitter? We had him on Blogging Heads. He's just surfacing now. He's starting to go on actual TV. He was on Blogging Heads a month ago, and he just has been traveling around forever. But you're right. I don't think mainstream media is investing in that. You know, MSNBC sent Chris Hayes to West Virginia, but that was very much kind of ideologically driven. We could do a better job of understanding what actually motivates Trump voters, which is, you know, three of my four siblings voted for Trump. Mm-hmm. And I would, to the extent that I understand why they did it, I would characterize the three differently. I mean, there's all kinds of motivations out there.
Yeah.
And it's worth understanding. I guess we could agree on that. Anything else you want to say about, we've been doing this an hour, so I guess it's time to check out, but any last words of wisdom?
Last words of wisdom. Well, maybe I'll throw out a question for Blogging Heads viewers. I'm starting to think about California, and it's just the 25th anniversary of the LA riots right now. And I was thinking about this moment back 25 years ago when there was this kind of populist freak out in California about both crime and immigration that followed pretty closely. It was happening around the time of the riots, and there were a couple of anti-immigrant ballot propositions, and people were looking at the demographics of the state and looking at different crime statistics and convincing themselves as they projected things out that this was going to be a dystopia pretty soon. And then 25 years passes and lots more immigrants have come meanwhile, and crime has fallen pretty dramatically. And the economy here is relatively good compared to the rest of the country, and people aren't freaking out anymore. And in fact, California, white voters in California voted very differently than white people in the rest of the country in their relationship to Trump. So I'm just trying to think about why this shift happened, and insofar as it's an example of a multi-ethnic polity that works relatively well, still has lots of flaws, of course, but, you know, people generally get along. Why is it that this has worked insofar as it has? So if anyone has ideas, I would love to hear. And if you have ideas, I'd love to hear too.
Okay. I will reflect on it myself. The, you've got another open source question in the Atlantic you put out. Were college students better off before social media?
Yes, I will have responses up soon.
Okay, so you've gotten enough responses on that, so we will see the answer before long. Thank you, Connor. As I had expected, this was an exercise in civility and non-snark and earnestness. People can find you, in addition to seeing yourself at the Atlantic, they can find you at Twitter at Connor64, even though you're too young to have been born in 1964, so the provenance of that handle is something of a mystery.
Yeah, I may be the 64th Connor to have joined Twitter. It's possible.
Oh, really? I think you should have left that a mystery.
I think, in fact, I was the 64th Connor to join Hotmail years ago and have held.
Oh, and you stuck with it then. You actually counted up? You actually found a list and counted the Connors?
Oh, well, I think it probably suggested, you know, like, here's a suggestion. Your name, Connor at Hotmail does not work. You can have Connor 64, 65, or 66.
I see.
Yes.
And so
this is my memory of it. Other anyway.
Yeah. Okay.
So only Blogging Heads viewers will get the true behind the scenes tidbits.
And we asked them not to tell anyone. Yeah. Lest it dispel the mystique surrounding.
Keep
you.
It in the family.
Okay. Well, thanks, Connor. Let's do this again down the road.
All right. Thank you. Have a good one.
Okay. See ya.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.